walking toward the gangplank. "Industry and determination, Mr. Kettle, can transform the difficult into the routine," Grimm said. "We can assume they'll move from the ventilation tunnels into the side tunnels, and from there proceed to their objectives. There are a number of possible targets for them to assault within Habel Morning, and they may try for the shipyards as well. Our mission is to keep them bottled up in the side tunnels. We needn't hunt them down. I dare say our own marines will be happy to do it once they return." Grimm looked over his shoulder and saw his crew following him, some of them still buckling their swords and gauntlets into place. Kettle had found most of them in a remarkably short time, 87 men, only 9 short of her full complement. It seemed they had all been together, and rather nearby, to place their bets on that duel. How many, Grimm wondered, would still be alive when the sun set? "Mr. Creedy, pass the word to the officers, if you please. Make sure every single one of them understands our goal, and that I expect it to be met regardless of what happens to the officers or myself. They are to inform the men in their squad the same way."
"Aye, Captain,"
Creedy said, and immediately turned to begin walking backward, speaking in terse tones to the first of the crewmen behind them.
"Mr. Journeyman," Grimm called, without turning his head.
"Aye, Captain."
"You stay."
An incredulous, absolutely acidic epithet split the air. "I believe the phrase you used was jumped-up wallypog. If you are too valuable to show proper deference and courtesy to my XO, you're certainly too valuable to risk in a firefight with the roaring marines, Journeyman. That's how it is." The engineer's ongoing curses faded into the background as Grimm began to trot forward, and his men came with him. They descended a spiral ramp that led from the shipyard to Habel Morning, fighting against confused traffic heading in the opposite direction. The Habel was in chaos. The bombardment from the Auroran destroyers had not struck the Habel directly, but enough of the energy had transferred through the spire stone to dislodge a significant amount of masonry used to buttress and repair the spire's roof. There were screams and the scent of smoke on the air. That was terrifying. If an enemy was lurking, he could be fought, but if smoke began to fill the Habel or its tunnels, it could kill every one of his men without a blade being drawn or a gauntlet discharged. Members of the Spyrarch's guard rushed here and there, rescuing those who had been trapped in the rubble or tending to the injuries of the wounded. It was a dutiful reaction to the crisis, but not a well-ordered one. They moved in small groups of 3 or 4, with no obvious coordination. No one was attempting to direct or calm the traffic on the atrium's streets as far as Grimm could tell.
"Sir," Creedy said, pointing.
Grimm swiveled his gaze to the far side of the Habel, where flickers of brilliant white light played intermittently against the far wall, changing the buildings between into black outlines.
"Firefight," Grimm said. "Good eyes, XO. Shall we greet our guests?"
Without waiting for an answer, he set out at a rather slow, if steady, lope. His arm hurt abominably, but there was nothing for it. Habel Morning occupied the entirety of the spire, most of it beneath a vast atrium nearly 200 feet high, and it was the next best thing to 2 miles from one side of the great cylinder that was Spire Albion to the other. They had to hurry, but arrive with enough breath to aim steadily and ply their blades. The run was like some kind of appalling dream. Most of the buildings seemed little damaged, but occasionally one would appear that had been crushed by falling masonry. The wounded lay on the spire-stone floor or wandered dazed through the streets. Grimm ground his teeth against the need to stop and help a small child who had obviously suffered a broken arm. The poor waif was in agony, but not in danger, which might not be true if the invaders managed to set enough of Habel Morning on fire, or blow up batteries or water gardens, or murder the Spire Council, though Grimm had mixed feelings on the sort of loss that might constitute, or any of a number of other acts of war that could have been underway. Perhaps a quarter of an hour passed while they ran, an eternity during any battle. By the time they reached the spot Creedy had seen, Grim had assumed that it would be most likely over. He was mistaken. As they approached, they could hear the howling discharges of gauntlet fire. Grim came to a panting halt just around the corner of a large house, one of the original dwellings from the building, made of spire stone seamlessly fixed to the Habbel's floor. The firing came from the other side.
"Stern,"
he said, fighting to keep his voice steady and calm.
"Get a look. Come back quick. No dawdling."
"Captain,"
said a slender, dark-haired man a good many years younger than the average crew member of the Predator. Stern had been a grubby midshipman in the deployment that had ended Grimm's career, and had, against Grimm's express instructions, followed him from the fleet onto Predator. He had remained small and thin as he grew into an adult, and could move as quickly and quietly as any warrior born when he needed to do so. Creedy was blowing hard after the run, his face red.
"Captain,"
he gasped,
"are we where I think we are?"
"Lancaster Vattery," Grim said. "They've come for the crystals."
"God in heaven, if the Aurorans destroy them..."
"Then Fleet will have to fight a war without replacement crystals or additional vessels," Grim said.
Which was, he reflected, saying something very nearly the same as losing a war.
Stern came hurrying back to the group.
"The Vattery's made of spire stone," he reported, "so there's no blasting a way in. Lancaster retainers are holding the door so far, but there aren't enough of them to keep it much longer."
"And the enemy?" Grim asked.
"Captain,"
Stern said, his voice worried.
"They're the Spyrarch's guards."
"Nonsense," Grim said promptly.
"Likely they're Aurorans wearing false uniforms."
"How many?"
"I made it 24, but they've taken up positions, sir. They're shooting from cover."
Creedy blinked.
"What?"
"If they want to destroy the Vattery, they should be storming the door, shouldn't they? Every minute they're here makes it more likely that they'll come under attack themselves. Why wait?"
"Hmm," Grim said, and narrowed his eyes, thinking, "Why wait?"
Then he felt his lips bare his teeth in a smile.
"Why indeed? Because they are waiting.
Perhaps they're expecting reinforcements."
"Stern, where are they positioned?"
"There's a masonry wall around a little garden between the Vattery and the house, Captain. It's been chewed up by gauntlet fire, but they're using it for cover."
Grim nodded once.
"Creedy, take 2 squads and flank them from the far side rear, if you please. I'll take the rest and make sure that the enemy is too busy looking at the near side front to notice you. Don't dawdle now." The XO nodded, pointed to 2 other officers, and beckoned. He started away at a run, and the others followed. Grim turned to the rest of the crew and said,
"These boys are better at this kind of fighting than us. But there are a hell of a lot more of us than there are of them. So we treat this exactly like a boarding action. Aggression, 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 and stay together. God in heaven be with you."
He led his crew to circle the house and enter the field opposite from where Creedy's team would appear. When Creedy got there, he and his men would be behind the Auroran's cover, blasting away at invaders trapped against a stone wall. They would wreak havoc on the foe. Of course, it also meant that the Aurorans would have a very strong defensive position against Grim and his men. But there was no helping that. The howl of gauntlet fire filled the air, the light flashing swift and bright in a thick, deadly curtain of energy. Grim drew his sword, lifted it, and cried,
"Albion!"
The crew's weapons leapt into their hands, and they roared, "Albion!" in furious unison. Grim rounded the last corner, followed by 70 howling aeronauts, and sprinted toward the Auroran position.
Chapter 15. Spire Albion, Habbel Morning, Lancaster Vattery. 2 seconds. Grim and his crew had 2 whole seconds of surprise and confusion in which to advance on the enemy. 2 seconds was a great deal of time when measured in units of life and death. They had covered perhaps half of the open ground before the Aurorans managed to gather their wits, and an officer began barking orders, redirecting their aim. The glow of a couple of dozen weapon crystals lit the dimness, shining like spotlights, and they began to pour fire into Grimm's crew, mostly from gauntlets, but also from several long guns. Grimm's men returned fire as they ran, wildly inaccurate for the most part, but anything that helped make the Aurorans flinch or seek cover was desirable. Then it was horrible sound and blinding light and the feel of spirestone beneath his boots as he ran, sword aloft. 2 seconds more. By the end of it, 20 of his men were down, most of them screaming, some horribly still. Others had been hit in their ether silk tunics, and though they staggered as they ran, they kept going. Grimm saw the blast that hit him, slamming home into his ribs. For an instant he faltered, looking down, but the suit the old etherealist had lent him was evidently lined with ether silk of the highest quality. The blast had felt like little more than a stiff punch, unpleasant but hardly deadly, and though it had burnt and torn the outer layer of the suit's coat, the silk beneath was unmarred. And then Grimm had reached the blast-pocked walled garden. The wall was more decorative than functional, being only about as high as his stomach, except where gauntlet blasts had lowered it in gaps to only a couple of feet high. Grimm stomped his boot down onto one such gap and leapt into the garden and passed the rank of men defending the wall, making room for the men coming behind him. He saw a pale face before him and whipped his sword in a quick strike, felt it hit. Then there was a flicker of steel, and he ducked beneath one of the inward-curving talon-like blades of the Auroran Marines and parried a second blade of the same kind. Then Kettle bounded through the gap in the wall, sweeping one large boot into the teeth of the man defending the opening as he did. The helmsman landed, his gauntlet hand stretched out behind him, and put a blast into the head of another defender. And after that it was frantic motion, reflex and terror. Steel flashed, gauntlets screamed, and his crew fought to press into the garden, to put enough men through the wall to make the weight of numbers decide the matter. The Auroran Marines disagreed. These were hard-bitten men, professionals who were trained to excel in the mayhem of battle. They recognized the danger of losing the wall, of being surrounded by a numerically superior force, and they fought savagely, viciously. Grimm found himself driven back, Kettle by his side, while the crew kept trying to follow the pair of them in, only to be cut down mercilessly and precisely by the Auroran long gunners or the blades of the enemy marines. Grimm felt the momentum shift, felt the gathering determination of the Aurorans as they realized that they outclassed their opposition. In a few seconds more, he judged, the attack would be repulsed, leaving himself and Mr. Kettle subject to the attentions of enemy gauntlets. And then Creedy's squad arrived. They didn't shout. They ran in relative silence, their footsteps masked by gauntlet fire, by howls and screams, and took up position along the opposite wall of the garden. Creedy made it happen with excellent discipline. He made sure every man was at the wall, gauntlet lifted, arm braced, aimed, and ready to fire before he gave the order. The Aurorans, fully focused on repelling Grimm's assault, suspected nothing until the moment Creedy's first salvo felled nearly half of them. Grimm lunged forward, driving his sword into the breast of an officer whose silk had absorbed the blast that struck him. Kettle, at his side, intercepted a wild swing from another foe with his own blade, bellowing, "Albion!" As he did, his fellow aeronauts surged forward with a roar, copper-clad blades in hand, vaulting the low wall or leaping through the gaps, swamping the stunned invaders in their numbers. The surviving Aurorans lasted rather less than 2 seconds.
"Creedy," Grimm said a few moments later. "Report."
11 dead,"
Creedy said in a subdued, solemn voice.
"2 more who won't last long. 17 incapacitated by their injuries and as many walking wounded, sir." I've sent those wounded who can move back to Predator, with word to send Dr. Bagan at once.
Grim grunted.
The Aurorans?
3 live. They might not survive their injuries.
Have Bagan see to them the moment he's finished with our own. I should think that the powers that be will want to speak to them, eh?
No doubt, sir, Creedy said. I've put some of the older, calmer hands to guard them.
Good man, Grim said. Send someone to the Vatry and let them know that we're not trying to murder them.
I thought there might be nervous men with gauntlets inside, so I went myself, sir,
Creedy said. Grim felt his lips quirk.
I see that they didn't blast you, he noted.
No, sir, Creedy said, his tone serious. Armed retainers of Lancaster, sir, former Marines. Very good discipline. They're staying at their post, and their commander has gone to secure the household. From outside the garden, where the wounded had been laid out together, there was a low, groaning scream of pain. Grim looked up wearily from where he sat on a bench in the garden itself. There was a small burbling brook and a pool there, along with several dwarf trees and abundant green ferns, quite beautiful but for all the blood and corpses. The dead men stank of offal and excrement, the way they always did. It seemed undignified for a man's last remnants to be so foul, but that was the way of it. Grim tried to ignore the smell and the motionless forms alike. There were always unpleasant consequences to a battle. He rose, wearily, straightened his back, cleared his throat, and looked into the middle distance.
That was work well done, Mr. Creedy, in the battle and after. I've known men who didn't have half as much composure or sense in their first close-quarters action.
Creedy hesitated awkwardly before replying. Captains did not say such things to their junior officers in fleet. Creedy frowned at nothing in particular, which also happened to be in the middle distance.
Sir, he said.
Yes, I don't like it either, Grim replied. But as I cannot put you in for a combat ribbon or a commendation for unusual competence under fire, we must make do.
Yes, sir.
Grim nodded.
When time serves, I shall buy you a drink, and we'll not speak of it again.
Creedy nodded. I should think that perfectly acceptable, Captain Grim.
Good, Grim said. That's done.
As soon as Bagan gets here, gather the men and get ready to move. There are a great many more Aurorans out there somewhere, and we'll need to be ready to respond.
We captured 4 of their long guns intact, sir. Shall I issue them to the men?
Grim nodded once. Excellent notion. Give one to Mr. Stern. He's a fine shot. Have him pick a squad to use the rest.
Aye, sir, Creedy said, and left to see to it.
Captain,
Kettle said from where he'd been standing, silent and discreet, a long step away. His tone was a warning. Grim turned to find a tall man approaching in a black suit tailored almost exactly to the lines of a Marine's uniform. He wore a blade and a gauntlet, and his short brush cut of hair was grizzled. Even before Grim saw his eyes, he'd pegged the man as warrior-born from his lean build and grace.
"Captain Grim, I presume,"
the man said.
"Aye,"
Grim replied.
"You have the advantage of me, sir."
The tall man offered his hand and Grim shook it.
"Esterbrook," he said. "First armsman of House Lancaster. I'm glad for your intervention, Captain. 4-1 are stiff odds."
"The Aurorans seem to think so," Grim replied.
6 of you held off 2 full squads of professional Marines. Impressive."
"Brief,"
Esterbrook said. "Otherwise you'd need to use words like tragic, or maybe noble sacrifice."
"Thank you."
Grim found himself smiling up at the man.
"What can I do for you, sir?" "Lord and Lady Lancaster were in the residence and saw much of what just happened. They wish me to convey their thanks and their condolences for your losses, and to inform you that they have already sent for their personal physicians, and that they're preparing space in the house for your wounded. You needn't fear that your men will lack the best care available."
Grim felt something ease in his gut that he hadn't known had been paining him.
Please, sir, convey my heartfelt thanks to the Lancasters.
Esterbrook nodded.
Will.
He looked around and then at Grim again.
You're Francis Madison Grim, captain of the Perilous.
Grim felt his shoulders tighten.
Former acting captain, sir.
I am he.
I hear the Admiralty broke your sword, for cowardice.
Kettle made a growling sound. Esterbrook glanced up, arching an eyebrow at Kettle. But then he turned back to Grim, clearly waiting for an answer.
They did, sir,
Grim said. Esterbrook showed his teeth.
But you'll charge a dug-in position of Marines, with one arm in a sling.
It was necessary to do it, Grim said.
We all serve, sir, some with more glory than others.
Esterbrook seemed to consider the multiple meanings in Grimm's answer and said,
Right. The Admiralty has its head up its nethers again.
Grim arched an eyebrow and said nothing. Behind him, Creedy shouted out an order, and the remaining aeronauts began to gather together. Bagan had arrived, as had two other men with the distinct confidence and focus of physicians in a crisis. His men were being cared for. He felt his chest ease as if it had been suddenly cut free from tight leather bonds. Esterbrook looked at the gathering men and said,
You're moving out.
I can't imagine that the crystal battery was the enemy's only target, Grim replied.
And I do not think the men we took down were operating alone. They seemed to be waiting for some other support to arrive.
Esterbrook nodded.
What I thought, too. I'd offer to send a few men with you, but...
Others may yet attack the Vatry, and your duty is to the Lancasters, Grim said. Albion must not lose the Vatry.
I'll leave a squad with you to help secure it until the Marines, or the True Guard, arrives.
Esterbrook ducked his head once.
I'm grateful to you, Captain. I have wounded of my own. Where are you headed next?
I intend to patrol the perimeter of the atrium, and... With no warning whatsoever, a ginger tomcat sailed over the garden wall and sprinted toward them. Kettle let out a brief sound of surprise, his hand darting toward his sword on reflex. The cat hurtled up to Esterbrook and slid to a halt with a long, chewy-sounding burble of throaty sound. Esterbrook blinked down at the cat and held up a hand.
Wait, wait, slow down.
The cat seemed to bound back and forth in place, stiff-legged, as if he could barely keep himself from breaking into another sprint. The stream of agitated feline sound continued.
"The beastie's gone mad, sir,"
Kettle asked.
"Not mad, I think," Grim said.
"Mr. Esterbrook, can you understand him?"
"I only speak a bit,"
Esterbrook said.
"He's... there... danger." Help. Those I understood.
He shook his head.
What danger? Who needs help?
Wait, Kettle said. I know they're clever beasts, but do you mean the things actually talk?
The cat turned two frantic circles and then darted over to the corpse of a fallen Auroran Marine in his stolen uniform. He stopped to make sure they were all looking at it and then deliberately swiped the dead man's chest, hissing.
More of them?
Esterbrook said.
Like that one?
The cat made another sound that Grim could have sworn was an exasperated affirmative.
Merciful builders, Kettle breathed. Is the man serious?
My bosun on Perilous kept a cat aboard, Grim said. The little monster was not to be underestimated. He looked up at Esterbrook.
Is this creature known to you?
Yes, Esterbrook said at once.
He is. His name is Raoul.
Then it would appear I know where I'm going next, Grim said calmly. Raoul whirled to look directly at Grim, wide eyes intense. Then he let out another mrowling sound and darted back toward the wall of the garden. He leapt to the top and paused to look back over his shoulder.
Mr. Creedy, Grim called. We're moving out.
Aye, sir,
Creedy said.
Where are we headed, Captain?
Raoul leapt down and darted into the dimness, pausing 30 yards later to look back. Grim started moving, Kettle at his side.
At the quick march, Mr. Creedy. Follow that cat.
Chapter 16. Spire Albion. Habble Morning. Ventilation Tunnels.
Bridget had never really given much thought to what it might be like to be held prisoner with her captor's hand quite literally threatening to choke the life out of her. But she felt quite sure that she would never have imagined that the experience would primarily be tedious. At first she had been racked with confusion and fear, but in the standoff that came after she had been taken, she felt increasingly humiliated, insulted. What kind of fool was she to let herself be taken prisoner and used against her own spire by its enemies, and right in front of Benedict? The Auroran warrior-born marine, Siriaco, held her back firmly against his chest, with one arm wrapped around her stomach and the other hand lightly holding her throat. Initially she had thought that she might be able to take him off guard and throw him, but at the slightest shift in her weight, Siriaco's hand would close and shut off her air entirely. After several minutes of tense silence, Bridget turned her head enough to see part of Siriaco's face.
"Just so you know," she said, "you're holding me uncomfortably. My back is going to start cramping. When it does, I'm not going to be able to hold still."
"I'm sure you'll be missed,"
the Auroran replied calmly, giving a little twitch of the fingers around her throat by way of demonstration.
Benedict, his eyes locked on the Auroran, let out a low and utterly inhuman-sounding growl.
"Careful, boy," Siriaco drawled. "If you let it out right now, it's not going to end well for any of us."
"I'm quite serious," Bridget said. "Sir, if my back starts to cramp and I begin to spasm and you kill me for it, my friend will most certainly come for you and matters will devolve."
From where she still lay on the floor, aiming her gauntlet at the explosives, Gwen said, "One might even say explosively devolve."
The Auroran grinned at that.
"Damnation, but I admire women with spirit. But it's been my experience that prisoners who do anything at all are prisoners who are trying either to escape or to kill me. So you don't get an inch."
"There's another option you haven't considered," Bridget said.
"And what is that?"
"Take me. Leave your explosives here and depart."
"Nonsense," Gwen said.
"Miss Lancaster,"
Bridget said in a very cross and rather loud tone, "would you please stop helping me?
Your only solution necessitates, as its linchpin, the deaths of everyone standing in this tunnel. Why not let me take a pass at finding something a bit less sweeping?"
Siriaco let out an almost musical chuckle Bridget could feel along her spine.
"I'm listening. Why would I do such a thing?"
"Because it salvages as much as possible from the situation," Bridget said.
"I need those explosives."
"You don't get them,"
Bridget said in a frank tone.
"In very nearly every scenario that might play out here, you do not retain the explosives. If our reinforcements arrive, you do not get them. If your people arrive and someone doesn't make a perfect shot before my associate knows it's happening, you do not get them. If no one shows up, you do not get them. If my back cramps up and the chain of events progresses as we expect, you do not get them."
The Auroran made a rumbling sound.
"But consider. If you retreat and take me with you, you have the means to prevent my friends from opening fire, the threat to my life. Nor will you be pursued. If you leave the explosives, they will have little choice but to remain with them to prevent you from using them for their intended purpose."
"If not the explosives, then what profit do I have from this proposal?"
"You get to survive the hour," Bridget said. "Your men survive. You get to escape into the tunnels and fight another day."
Siriaco grunted his acceptance of the statement.
"And what do you get?"
"You don't get to blow up whatever you'd planned to blow up," she replied. "And both of my friends survived the hour."
He growled. "And what do you get, miss?"
"Raped and murdered, likely," she said. "But as that decision will hardly be up to me, there seems no point in dwelling on it. I'm a bit new to this sort of thing, Sergeant. But it seems to me that standing around hoping for some soldier who might or might not come along to be perfectly stealthy and to make a perfect shot at the correct target on his first attempt seems to be a course of action with a very low probability of success, especially when any failure or incorrect decision on his part means that everyone dies in an explosion. By contrast, my proposal guarantees your immediate survival and gives you hope to survive the future, to possibly negotiate better terms for a surrender, or even to escape Albion altogether."
One of the other soldiers evidently spoke Albion, because he looked from Bridget to Siriaco and said something in a tense voice. The warrior-born marine snapped out a brief, savage-sounding answer.
"By all means, discuss it,"
Bridget said.
"The more we talk, the more likely we'll find some sane way to end this." And, Bridget thought, it would give Raoul more time to find another solution. She only hoped he had better sense than to stage some sort of one-cat surprise assault. "Sergeant, surely you must see that..."
Siriaco's fingers tightened again, shutting off her air, and he said in a mildly irritated voice,
"You people can't get enough of the sound of your own voices, can you? I'm thinking."
"She doesn't say it well," Benedict said in a low, hard voice. "But she's right. Whatever your mission was, you've little chance of accomplishing it as planned now. And the longer you stay here, the more likely it is that something bad happens to all of us."
"Something tells me," the Auroran said, "that you aren't going to just stand there while I walk away with the girl."
"That will depend," Benedict said.
"On what?"
"What happens to her," he said.
"Treat her with respect and release her unharmed, and we're all just soldiers."
"And if I don't?" Benedict was quiet for a moment before he said,
"It's personal."
Bridget, who had not been able to breathe during this exchange, slapped the fingers of one arm against Siriaco's steely forearms, as if tapping out one of Benedict's holds in training.
"Hm?"
Siriaco said. Then,
"Ah, yes."
His fingers loosened, and Bridget sucked in a lungful of air. The motion shifted her weight by some minuscule degree. And so quietly that she almost thought she'd imagined it for a moment, Siriaco made a sound of pain. Bridget froze, considering that. That was right. The Auroran had taken a gauntlet blast to the shoulder. She could still smell the stench of charred cloth and what might have been burnt flesh. The wound had been significant enough that he had feared to challenge Benedict to battle. In fact, now that she considered it, the hold Siriaco had on her was hardly an efficient one. A few weeks of training did not make her an expert, but she knew that he could have been holding her locked quite easily with his right arm, freeing his gauntlet hand. Instead, his left arm was wrapped around her midsection, and not particularly tightly. Why not? Obviously because he could not. He might not be able to lift his arm at all. That would explain why he wouldn't allow her to shift her position. His left arm might be a good deal less strong than he would like her to believe, and she was tall enough that if she altered her posture, the fingers on her throat would not have a surer grip. Granted, the fingers of his right hand held her windpipe like a vice, and were perfectly sufficient to the task of killing her, or to dissuade her from testing the strength of his left arm. There might be a way for her to escape, she realized. But it all depended upon the Auroran's resolve. How willing was he to kill her?
"Albion," Siriaco said, "do not for one second think that I'm afraid of your taking things personally." "If you're not afraid..." "Let go of the girl," Benedict said. I'm fearless, Siriaco replied in a dry tone. Not stupid. And as smart as it would be to accept her offer, it isn't going to happen.
Bridget turned her head toward him again. Why ever not?
Because I am a loyal son of Aurora, Siriaco said. And I have a duty. I'll fulfill it, or die trying.
After a moment he said in a softer tone, And miss, however this turns out, if we'd taken you, I'd have gutted any man who tried to lay a hand on you. If it had to be death, I'd have given it to you clean and quick.
To be clear, you're not a rapist, Bridget said, but you are a murderer.
You seem to have it surrounded, miss, he said.
He sounded entirely sincere, which made any attempt to exploit his weakened arm something best left to a moment of desperation. Though her back began to twinge again, and she feared that moment was rapidly drawing nigh. The two groups fell into a tight, withering silence for a moment more, and then the rather eerie voice of a cat echoed through the dim hallway.
"Little mouse,"
Raoul said.
"Help comes."
Siriaco tensed at once at the sound, looking up and down the hallway as though seeking its source, but even the remarkable eyes of the warrior-born were not able to see into blackness from a small and relatively well-lit area.
"This may be your last opportunity, Sergeant," Bridget said. "Walk away."
Siriaco made a growling sound in his chest. "Cats are a vicious little plague, but they don't frighten me either, miss."
Several of the other Aurorans spoke in their home spire's tongue, a quick, terse exchange, which was ended when Siriaco growled the same phrase he'd used a moment before. Then his eyes widened, and he snapped out another order. The Aurorans looked at one another, but lowered their gauntlets and started backing out the way they'd come.
"Stay with me, miss," Siriaco said in a low tone. "Albion, you step over by your little friend on the ground. We're going."
Benedict narrowed his eyes, but then his nostrils flared, and he nodded as if in understanding. He took several steps until he stood over Gwen.
"Remember," he said to Bridget, "our first lesson."
Bridget blinked at him. The first thing to learn, as he had often repeated while instructing her, was how to fall.
Of course. That hadn't been the first lesson, had it?
It seemed rather suicidal, but perhaps Benedict's judgment in these matters was better than her own. So though it made her heart race with sudden, quivering terror, Bridget moved. She braced her feet and clamped her hands down onto Siriaco's right forearm, bending forward with all of her strength, much as she would when tossing a side of beef forward and over her shoulder. And several things happened very quickly. First, something like a collar of fire closed around her neck. Siriaco was no novice of battle. Instead of being thrown over her shoulder, he took a smooth pair of steps circling around her, and as a result he was only lifted a few inches clear of the floor. As soon as she felt his weight pivoting away from him and onto her own legs, Bridget pushed her body back as hard as she could and slammed his wounded shoulder between her body and the spirestone wall. He let out a startled snarl of pain, and the deathly grip on her throat loosened. A crackling lance of etheric energy burned across Bridget's field of vision and struck one of the Auroran Marines square in the head. He went down in a heap of motionless limbs. The first bolt was followed by three more, half a heartbeat later, and though two failed to score, the other struck an Auroran in the thigh, sweeping his leg from beneath him and slamming him to the floor. Bridget had no chance at all in pitting her muscles against the warrior-born's stony strength. Both of her arms did not serve to overpower his single limb. So she kept slamming her body against his wounded shoulder, seized upon a single one of his fingers with both of her capable hands, and bent it back savagely. Siriaco screamed a furious word, and then Bridget found herself flying forward through the air until she struck the far wall of the tunnel. It was a rather startling experience, particularly the sudden stop. Her arms and legs stopped working properly,
and as she bounced off the wall, she felt herself falling, and she couldn't breathe. She wound up on the floor, and then the two crystals the Aurorans had been using for light winked out, leaving nothing but blackness, broken only by dazzling flashes of etheric light. The floor seemed quite cool and comfortable for some reason, and she was content to remain there. The flashes of light ceased their bickering, and a moment later she felt Raoul's nose gently nuzzling her cheek. She made the effort to move her hand and assure him that she was all right. Then she heard voices and light sprang up in the tunnel. A great many men with weather-worn clothing, weather-worn faces, and odd, heavy-looking tunics had appeared. They were all armed with gauntlet and blade, but for four who carried long guns, their copper coils gleaming, their overheated barrels giving off trickles of steam as they boiled away the water from their little storage tanks. One man appeared from their midst, and Bridget picked him out immediately as their leader. He was of only average height. His suit was rather mismatched and patchy, and one of his arms was held in a sling. But there were the marks of gauntlet fire on the suit, and he was sprinkled with blood that did not appear to be his own. The man moved with an absolute surety of purpose, with unbroken focus, and the men around him deferred to him with an obvious, silent respect that could not have been expressed in words. He took a quick look around and said, "Excellent shot, Mr. Stern." A slender little man, holding a long gun, touched a finger to an imaginary cap. "Baker made the good shot, sir. Legged him. We've got a prisoner to talk to."
"Good work. See to him."
"Aye, Captain."
The man turned and approached Bridget. Raoul immediately stepped up onto Bridget's chest, sat, and regarded the man with narrow eyes and a low growl.
"Excuse me," he said to the cat, "but you did wish me to help her, did you not?"
The cat's eyes narrowed further. The man extended his hand to Bridget and asked,
"Can you rise, miss?"
Bridget made a hushing sound of reassurance to Raoul, took the man's hand, and slowly rose, gathering Raoul into her other arm as she did.
"Yes, thank you, sir."
It hurt to speak.
The man inclined his head politely.
"My name is Grimm."
He looked over to where a tall and very handsome younger man was helping Gwen to her feet.
"Mr. Creedy, detail a squad to secure those explosives, if you please."
"Aye, Captain,"
said the tall young man. Bridget suddenly felt a bit dizzy, and then Benedict was at her side, one of his hands beneath her elbow, offering her gentle support.
"The Aurorans,"
she asked him, "what happened?" "They took your advice, minus the part where they abducted you, for which I cannot help but feel grateful," Benedict replied.
"I was going to lift him and throw him like you told me," Bridget said, "but it didn't work. I'm sorry."
Benedict blinked. "Is that what you thought?" "No, no. I caught the scent of Captain Grimm and his men coming once Raoul returned, and thought a crossfire was imminent. I meant for you to fall."
Bridget blinked.
"Oh, it's... in retrospect, it's rather obvious when you phrase it in that manner."
Benedict lifted her chin gently with a couple of fingers and peered at her neck.
"I must admit, though, he certainly didn't see it coming."
He poked at her throat gently with his fingertips.
"Ow,"
Bridget said calmly. "A physician should look at this," Benedict said, his voice worried. Gwen had gone to Barnabas's side and looked up from the wounded man.
"Him, too. He seems to be unconscious."
She rose and went to Grimm.
"Captain, can you spare any men to help us with our wounded?"
"Of course, miss," Grimm said, inclining his head in a little bow. "I'll have them taken to where my own men are being treated at House Lancaster, if that suits you."
Gwen arched her eyebrows rather sharply and said,
"I suppose that will do."
"Mr. Creedy," Grimm said, "you will take a squad to get the civilians to safety and the prisoner and confiscated material to a secure location. I will continue the sweep and meet with you back at House Lancaster. Mr. Stern, take point again, if you please."
And as quickly as they had come, most of the aeronauts and their captain departed. The tall young man saw to the loading of the explosives back onto their stretcher, and men to carry them, and made sure the captured Auroran wasn't going to bleed to death or bolt. Then he turned to them and said,
"Ladies,
sir, if you could come with me, please. We shouldn't linger here until we're sure it's clear of more of the enemy." Bridget still felt somewhat confused.
"Benedict,"
she said,
"I'm sorry, but I don't understand. Is the fighting over?"
His expression darkened.
"No," he said quietly. "I think it's just getting started."
Chapter 17. Spire, Albion. Havel, morning. House of Master Ferris. Folly sat up in her bed in the little loft over the Master Etherealist's library, covered in a cold sweat, her heart racing, her breath heavy. She sat there dully for a mute moment. Terror left a sour miasma in the air around a person. Not something one could smell, even if she had the sharpest of noses, but she always felt that she could detect its stench for some reason.
"Teacher,"
Folly called,
"it would seem I've had the dream again."
"Did you catch it?" the master called back. "If you didn't, I should say that the dream has had you."
Folly sat up and looked around her little loft. Her stacks and stacks of jars, full of little-used illumination crystals — she would never understand the phrase "burnt out" in reference to the crystals that no longer responded to an average human will — gave the entire place a soft, aqua glow. She turned to check her dream catcher. Between two stacks of glass jars was a funnel web woven of individual strands of ether silk. Folly checked the web and the small etheric cage at the narrow end of the funnel, built of a neutral crystal in a frame of copper wire. Really, Folly thought, it was quite a good thing that she was an etherealist's apprentice, because she would have made a remedial spider. The funnel web had dozens of sagging strands, and several of them had even parted completely, their loose ends floating away from her fingers as she brushed them near. It was lopsided. The curl of the spiral didn't close in a steady curve. And there were several obvious lumps in the design, where her knots and glue work had been clumsy. But, she thought, that didn't mean that it was necessarily a bad web, especially for someone who had never had the same opportunity to learn afforded every spider. And the little crystal in the etheric cage was glowing with sullen, flame-coloured light.
"I am a successful self-taught spider, I think," she called down to Ferris.
"I always hoped you would grow into one," Ferris said.
His chair scraped on the floor, and footsteps approached the ladder to the loft. The ladder groaned as he came up it and eyed the trap.
"By the builder's Folly! What a marvellous little gnat-catcher you are!"
Folly smiled and bounced a little as he spoke, reaching for the cage. The small assembly promptly retreated from her outreached hand, and the crystal seemed to strain against its copper cage, buzzing and vibrating against the metal like an angry wasp. She blinked several times and took her fingers away from it, reminded of the unpleasant relationships enjoyed between some spiders and some wasps.
"Ah!" Ferris cackled. "Ah, you did it. I thought as much."
"I just told you that I did it, teacher," Folly pointed out.
"Not you," Ferris said in a testy voice. "I was speaking of the enemy."
Folly tilted her head and regarded the little copper framework.
"There's an enemy?"
"God in heaven, yes," Ferris said. "I'm sure I told you. I distinctly remember doing so."
"Perhaps that was tomorrow, teacher."
"It may be," Ferris said. "But yes, quite. Enemy, capital E."
"If one is to have an enemy, one might as well have a respectable one. And this dream?"
"It is an enemy sending,"
I rather suspect it was more of a folly taking,
Ferris replied.
Give it to us. Let's have a look.
Folly considered the problem for a moment, then carefully reached her hand down on the far side of the copper cage. She moved her hand toward it, and it began to buzz again, moving away. She herded it over to the edge of the loft, and Ferris caught it handily as it leapt away from her.
"Excellent," he said, his tone pleased.
The old etherealist leaned down to peer at the crystal.
"Let's see what's been on your mind, eh?"
His eyes glittered brightly. And then the old man fell silent, staring. Folly rose from her bed, took off her nightclothes, and put on clothes that felt right for today. A red stocking. A grey stocking with blue speckles. A plain dress of yellow cotton, and a dozen brightly coloured scarves that she tied in a row down each arm, using her teeth to finish the knots. Then she strapped on a pistolier's gun belt, minus the unreliable weaponry, and filled the holsters with small mesh sacks of dim little etheric crystals instead. They were not used to being carried that way, but it would be a good learning experience for them, she thought. She completed the outfit with several more scarves that went around her neck, and wound a long knitted scarf about her head. It was hot, but she thought it suited today, and she felt ever so much better once she had finished dressing. She had time to dress and to sit down and begin telling all of her little crystals good morning when the master let out a long, slow breath and lowered the etheric cage with its sullen crystal heart. He looked awful. His face was grey, his eyes sunken.
"Teacher?"
Folly said. She moved to the edge of the loft and crouched beside him, reaching out to touch his head, which was fever-hot.
"What did you see?"
"Ascending indeed," he said. "This was no dream. No etheric echo, my girl."
"I believe it was a message."
Folly blinked. "A message? Sent by ether? Is such a thing possible?"
"A moment ago, I would have said that it was not," he replied, his eyes still far away. "But it would seem that someone has worked out how it might be done, though just as clearly they had no idea that they might be overheard."
"You think I've been eavesdropping in my dreams? I trust that is not an assessment of my character, teacher."
"No,"
he said slowly. He often spoke so when his mind was fully focused on some task.
"No, child. Your nightmares of late. You've been hearing their whispers for, what, 2 weeks now?"
"About that, yes," Folly said. "But, teacher, how is it that I heard them and you did not?"
"That is an excellent question.
I will give it consideration." He took a slow breath and then said, "By the way, we're at war as of an hour ago. I didn't think it was worth waking you for."
"I may have missed this dream message otherwise,"
Folly said seriously.
"I suppose it would be disorienting to have an enemy but no war."
"Let us not make assumptions," the master said.
"Then I will make a question or two, if you do not mind."
"Rarely."
"You say this was a message. To whom was it sent?"
"Points for grammar, Folly."
Ferris rubbed at his chin.
"Another etherealist, almost certainly. Are there any others in Havelmorning?"
Ferris shook his head.
"Not for a great many years now. The nearest is Bernard Fezzig, down in Havel Solis, I think. But he's utterly mad, you know."
Folly carefully straightened one of the hundreds of jars of exhausted crystals that had inexplicably become slightly misaligned.
"The poor man." "It happens to the best of us," Ferris said,
and slid back down the ladder, bouncing the trapped etheric message in one palm. He had, Folly noted, forgotten to put on his clothing that morning, except for a pair of thick black socks and his sleeping cap.
"I have an intuition,"
Is it a fine one?
I think we shall need that Grimm, Captain.
Captain Grimm?
Don't correct my grammar. It's an aesthetic choice of word order. But yes, that fellow whose arm had been infected.
What shall we need him for?
He seemed capable and polite, and it's so rare to meet someone who is actually polite for the proper reasons. He paused. Is it cold in here?
You need to put on your warm robe, teacher, Folly suggested diffidently.
Ah, yes. I knew I'd forgotten something, child. Thank you.
The master picked up a robe. There were several he'd absently discarded over the past few weeks, strewn about the library floor, and put it on, inside out. But he was very busy thinking. Folly could tell from the set of his jaw. He was doing very well just to get his arms into the proper holes when he was in that state of mind. Folly finished touching each jar of little crystals and then carefully climbed down the ladder. It wasn't until she was halfway across the room that she heard a sharp, heavy crashing sound from the front hall. Ferris's head whipped around toward the sound, his eyes glittering fever-bright, flicking left and right at random distances. He lifted one hand to point, and his voice was a silken snarl.
Folly! By that wall! Down low!
Folly hurried to obey. When the master scanned that many futures that rapidly and spoke in that voice, one really had to be quite stupid to do otherwise. She dropped into a low crouch, kept her feet beneath her in case she needed to run, and reached into her holsters to give her little crystals reassuring pats, in case they had become frightened. Ferris nodded and absently held out his right arm. The crystal on the head of his cane let out a soft chime as he sent out a current of etheric energy from his fingertips, and then the implement sailed gracefully across the room and into his hand. Just as it did, the doors to the library crashed open, and three men, wearing uniforms that closely approximated those of the Spyrarch's guard, entered the room. They carried all manner of soldierly equipment, including gauntlets and blades. One held an axe that he had just used on Ferris's fine wooden door, and his companions both advanced with their gauntlets raised and glowing. They discharged the gauntlets within a second of one another, and brilliant energy flooded the room, a torrent of destruction meant to rip the old man facing them to shreds. Folly winced and experienced something she felt quite sure was pity for the poor fools. Ferris simply lifted his cane, and the crystal at its tip drew in the deadly bursts of etheric energy as a sponge soaked up water. He held the cane forth, and the crystal continued to drink down etheric force from the weapons crystals of the enemy gauntlets, yanking the power from them in one long continuous burst. Gauntlets were not designed for that kind of steady discharge of energy, and they began to shed heat almost instantly, the copper wires that served as a cage for the weapons crystal, encasing the user's forearm, smoldered, heated, and began to glow. The two men let out pitiable screams and fell, scrambling with leather straps and buckles that scored the fingertips of their right hands even as they tried to unfasten them. The third man looked at the other two and showed a spark of intelligence. He stripped his gauntlet rapidly, dumping it on the floor. But then he ruined his brain's hard work by drawing his copper-clad sword and advancing on the master, holding his axe in one hand, the sword in the other. Ferris gave his head an impatient shake, lifted his cane, and sent a single flickering dart of searing light across the room. It flew in a sinuous, erratic pattern, winding around a column and beneath a table, and slithering through several stacks of books before hammering into the broadside of the axe's heavy, copper-covered steel head. The bolt melted a hole 3 inches across through the steel, sending out an enormous burst of sparks and flares of flickering fire. And the man yelped and dropped the weapon, turning to stare with wide eyes at the master.
Ferris said calmly, "You are trespassing, sir. Be gone, while you still can."
With each word, a brilliant, tiny wisp of light, like the first, flickered out of the crystal and began orbiting around the master's white-fringed head in a beautiful, deadly crown of etheric fire. The man licked his lips and then looked behind him. His wounded companions had managed to rip the gauntlets from their arms.